A new student, really, in cosmology. I don't claim to be an expert. I'm still learning. I came into it just from a totally different point of view, and I ended up with a model that coincided with work that Neil and Paul had been doing. And so we found each other, and we are having great fun developing theory some more. So initially we started with Chen, who used to be my student and now a postdoc, being interested in two-time physics and then that predicting a particular model and some trying to understand some features of that model. And for that we needed to understand trying to solve the cosmological equations that all of us are interested in. And then we found a method, a very beautiful method, of solving these equations exactly for a particular model. And then, since we found all the solutions, there were some features in the solutions that seemed pretty weird from the point of view of cosmology, and then this is how I started to talk to cosmologists and try to find out what they mean. And so by now we are having great fun, and this is what I'm going to tell you about. So in particular, what I'm going to show you is I will start from a particular model, and I will find all the solutions of Friedman's equations for that model, the complete set. And by knowing the complete set and also knowing how to make them geodesically complete through the singularity, we are able to say things that are not possible to say with only approximate solutions. So this is what I'm going to tell you about. And then eventually, what seems to be inescapable conclusion of that is that there is an anti-gravity period between every crunch and every bank. And so this will be something that I will show you as a consequence of solving equations exactly. So the model that I'm going to be dealing with is kind of a standard model that is used in cosmology most of the time. So this includes a scalar, which could be in the either an inflationary model or in the cyclic model. I'm not committed to one or the other a priori. So plus radiation and plus matter. Radiation, I'm going to deal with it in the sense of dust. I will start with the FRW metric, but I will discuss also anisotropic metrics eventually. So I will work in the conformal with conformal time. So T, usual T, and conformal time are related in the usual way. I will allow spatial curvature, K, defined in the usual sense. The Friedman equations, including radiation, including curvature, and the potential are the standard ones. And so these are the things that I'm going to solve exactly for a particular potential, so this particular potential. Now let me show you the parameter space of the solution. There are six parameters altogether, and I will allow all values of these parameters. So two of the parameters, B and C, are just parameters in the potential. K is the curvature, spatial curvature, and then rho zero is the coefficient, today's value of radiation, rho zero. And then there are also two initial values in trying to solve these equations. They are second-order differential equations, so therefore both for A and for sigma, you expect four initial conditions in solving two differential equations. So namely, the initial conditions both for both derivatives and the fields. However, there is one constraint, which is the energy constraint, that says you can eliminate one of those initial conditions. And then also there is time translation symmetry. And because of time translation symmetry, I can choose arbitrarily the time and one value of the fields arbitrarily at some arbitrarily chosen time. So I can drop that one. So therefore, I have two totally arbitrary initial parameters to deal with. So altogether, six parameters. And I will solve the equations exactly for this particular potential, allowing all the parameters to be in all possible ranges. Now, this seems kind of incredible, but it turns out to be, it becomes ridiculously simple, and I will show it to you all on the board, after you make a particular transformation. Okay, so now, once you do that, once you find all the solutions, you find that the generic solution is geodesically incomplete. So namely, when you go to the singularity, you find that, as usual, it is geodesically incomplete in the usual sense of geodesic incompleteness, that you, the trajectories of particles moving to the geodesic, you have to stop them at a finite time. However, there is a subset of geodesically complete solutions, but only with conditions on the parameter set. I will show you what they are, but then I will also understand what does it mean to make it geodesically complete and go through the singularity, allowing all the entire parameter set. All right, so all of that I can do exactly for the FRW case, but then if I also consider anisotropic metrics, in particular the Kasner metric and the Bianchi 9 metric, then I have to allow for two more fields that come as part of the metric, time-dependent fields, which then become important only near the singularity. So they are unimportant away from the singularity. They become important only near the singularity. So then I will solve the equations. It turns out that the equations become kinetic energy dominated. The potentials don't matter. And then, independent of whatever potential we start with, it's not necessarily this potential, any potential, still we will be able to solve the equations exactly and understand what geodesic completeness means. And this is what is going to show us how anti-gravity must always be there between crunch and bang. All right, so to understand the geodesic completeness eventually, I'm going to need to extend the theory a little bit, only by gauge degrees of freedom. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to add real degrees of freedom, but only gauge degrees of freedom, by starting to formulate the theory by demanding a local scaling symmetry, the Weyl symmetry. So if I require that, then I cannot write down the usual Einstein-Hilbert term because that has a scale, so this is not allowed. But what is allowed by the Weyl symmetry is to have conformally coupled scalars. And conformally coupled scalars just couple to the curvature with a particular coefficient, and then they have usual kinetic terms. Now, I want to explain why there must be a sign difference between a first scalar and then any other additional scalars that you can include. This is because I want eventually a coefficient in front of R which is positive. This is for physics reasons. So namely, the gravitational constant has to be a positive constant. So therefore, if I had only phi and not S, if I start only from phi, in order for that to be positive, it turns out that the kinetic term for phi must be negative by the gauge symmetry, by the Weyl gauge symmetry. So therefore, this is a ghost to start with. Phi appears to be a ghost to start with, but there is a gauge symmetry. So because there is a gauge symmetry, phi can always be set equal to a constant and then eliminated completely from the theory, so no ghost. And then we generate that way the Hilbert-Einstein term. So namely, the value of phi, which becomes just a constant, becomes the usual Einstein-Hilbert term. Now, if I add more scalars into the theory, such as S, then I cannot allow the wrong kinetic energy sign. I must have the correct kinetic energy sign. Otherwise, I'm going to have ghosts. And then the Weyl symmetry requires that it must come with the opposite sign to phi. So therefore, I must have a relative sign between this first phi and then any additional scalar that I'm going to include in the theory. So therefore, this overall factor plays the role now of a gravitational parameter. But then we can choose gauges. Okay. So now, first of all, let me say that this form of theory was a direct prediction from two-time gravity in 4+2 dimensions. I cannot go into those details now, although I would love to, but there is no opportunity in this talk to do that. And then the same form of the theory was also motivated by the colliding brain scenario of Steinhardt and Turok, and then McFadden and Turok's work makes this connection more evident with this particular form of the Lagrangian. So this is how we ended up coming together, because we ended up with the same model and with the same language. All right, so now the Weyl symmetry can be gauge fixed in several forms. So one form is to go directly to the Einstein gauge by choosing this overall factor to be a constant, and so then we just have the usual form of the Einstein theory with the Einstein-Hilbert term. And then in this gauge, which I'm labeling with an extra E just to emphasize that I'm in that particular gauge, so phi E is a cosh, SE is a sinh, so that the square difference is a constant. So in that gauge, G is the usual G, and so this action just becomes the usual action, which is where we wanted to start from. And then we can try to solve the equations, which I will show how, but to do that, I'm going to be taking advantage of this gauge symmetry, of the Weyl gauge symmetry. Now, we will see that from the solutions, we will see that this is not going to be the entire story, because we have to ask the question, we were able to choose this gauge only when we are in a patch of space-time when this overall coefficient is positive. So if it is positive, then I can choose that my gravitational parameter is actually positive. Then I can choose that gauge. But the question is the dynamics going to allow me to stay in that gauge forever? So if I start some motion in a patch of space-time when this quantity is positive, and then I turn on the dynamics, will I stay in that gauge? Will this sign always stay positive, or will it change sign? And then what we learned by actually solving the equations, which I will show you in a minute, is that, in fact, this is not possible most of the time. So the dynamics does push this factor to become negative. And so when that happens, of course, we end up with anti-gravity. So namely, the gravitational constant, rather than being positive, becomes negative. And once we move to that patch of space-time, then matter with other similar matter actually pushes each other, right? It becomes a repulsive force rather than an attractive force, and this is how we end up with anti-gravity. Yeah. The gravitons, yes. The gravitons are ghosts. Nothing else ends up being a ghost. This is true. But I'm about to tell you that this can happen only at the singularity. So namely, we are separated. Our universe is separated from that region of space-time always by a singularity. All right? So all the information, therefore, is at the singularity. Whether or not there is such a region, is all that information is only at the singularity. So it doesn't affect what we see today. All right, so now the other gauge in which everything is going to become very, very simple, I call it the gamma gauge. So in the gamma gauge, I label the fields by this gamma. And in that gauge, I choose the overall factor in front of the conformal factor in front of the metric. I choose it to be 1 for all space-time. All right, so this is the other gauge. And so in that case, the FRW metric loses the overall factor in front of it. And therefore, the curvature in that gauge is just a constant. And if you put that in the Lagrangian, then the Lagrangian for time-dependent fields only becomes this kinetic term. And this quadratic-type potential energy, which was R times R, which is now K, was multiplying a quadratic term like that. And then the potential term. I didn't mention before, but the potential has to preserve the local scale symmetry, and therefore it is of the form phi to the 4 times any function of the ratio. Now, in addition to equations of motion that will follow from this Lagrangian, we must remember that there is also an energy constraint before we choose the gauge. There was such a thing. And that's Einstein's equation, G0 is equal to T0. It simply corresponds to the Hamiltonian that you derive from this Lagrangian must be 0. So namely, it has to be at 0 energy. Okay, so you need to solve these equations that follow from there at zero total Hamiltonian. So now, what is the relation between one gauge and the other? Now, I will be able to solve the equations in this gauge. The reason for that will become apparent in a minute. But in any gauge, I still can give you the transformation from the E gauge, the Einstein gauge, to the gamma gauge. So that transformation goes as follows, that A squared in the Einstein gauge ends up being phi squared minus S squared in the gamma gauge. That's the transformation from one gauge to the other. And then the field that I called sigma before, the usual scalar, is this ratio of phis and S's. So I'm calling this the BCRT transform, and I have a feeling that it has something to do, at least formally, with the type of transformations that Roger was talking about, and he can tell me whether it is the case or not. So in this gauge, I think, is in the language of Roger, it is like where everything was on a cylinder, where there was no singularity at all. And you can see that in this Lagrangian equations of motion that you will derive from here, there are no singularities at all, because the curvature is in this gauge, the curvature is just a constant, and there are no singularities. The singularities was in the other gauge, and you can see that the singularity is going to appear only when phi squared is equal to S squared. All right. So now, how to get analytic solutions? I cannot do it analytically for all potentials, but for this particular potential, where this thing is just quartic only, you can see that this becomes a decoupled system. So namely, phi never talks to S if my interaction is just that. And then if you insert in this that when I go to the E gauge, to the Einstein gauge, that phi was cosh and S was sinh, if you do that, then this becomes the potential I told you about. All right, so the equations that you derive from this Lagrangian plus the energy constraint is this. The energy constraint has, in addition, also the radiation parameter. So this is the energy of the phi field, and this is the energy of the S field, and we are required to solve the differential equations. First integral of the differential equations just says that the energy of the S field is a constant, and that's an integration parameter. And then the energy of the phi field, solving that differential equation, just says that that energy is a constant, which says this quantity is a constant, but the total must add up to zero, so therefore the two energies, E phi and E s, are related to each other by one unknown parameter, which is E. So this is one of the parameters of integration that survive. So now this system is extremely easy to solve because it is the system of a particle in a potential problem where phi moves independently than S. The only requirement is that they must move with energies that are related to each other in this way. So again, the generic solution is going to have six parameters. The parameters are the potential, curvature, radiation, this parameter E, and one initial condition for phi, another initial condition for S. I can arbitrarily choose it at some arbitrary time. And that's because of the translation symmetry under tau. So I have a six-parameter space, but I can solve everything. So the way to solve it then is just to plot these potentials. So here is a plot for, in the case of k equals zero, it's just for S. So this is the phi to the four, S to the four potential. With a positive C. For phi, again, for k equal to zero, if B is positive, so this is the potential that phi sees. And then if B is negative, then this dotted line over there is the potential that phi would see if the sign of B is different. So the energy of S has to be in this well is going to be at some level. And the energy of phi has to be above that one by rho, by the amount of rho, but phi is going to move in that potential or in the dotted potential. So, you can see what is S going to do. S is just going to oscillate back and forth at that energy level. And what is phi going to do? Phi, if B is negative, it is also going to oscillate. Ooh, very fast. So they both oscillate independently. If they oscillate independently, then phi squared minus S squared is going to keep changing sign. Right? So they keep oscillating. One becomes larger than the other. And then phi squared minus S squared is going to change sign. So therefore, so that's the proof that we will easily go from gravity to anti-gravity. So now to understand what that is, I'm going to do the following. Given a particular solution, we can plot it in the phi S plane by doing a parametric plot. A parametric plot is going to, as tau goes forward, is going to be some curve that keeps going through the regions where phi is larger than S, to regions where phi is smaller than S, to regions from gravity regions to anti-gravity regions. So the patch for gravity is over here. The patch for anti-gravity is over there. So such a curve is going to cross the light cone. This thing that looks like a light cone is going to cross it. Every time it crosses the light cone, that's when you hit the singularity in the Einstein gauge. So, and this is the transformation between them. So therefore, the general solution is that you keep getting big bangs or big crunches at each time you move through the light cone, and the generic solution is a cyclic universe. If the oscillations of phi and s are such that their periods are an integer relative to one another, then it is a closed curve. Otherwise, it is a curve that keeps going and going and going and going, but not necessarily over itself. But in any case, it is cyclic. So that's the generic solution. I will skip what happens when you have curvature. There are interesting things, but there is no time. So now, are there geodesically complete solutions that never reach the anti-gravity region? And then there are. So I plotted here a solution. So in order to be able to do that, you need the following conditions: that you need a synchronized initial set of values. So S was already zero. I also need to take phi to be zero. And I also need to require that the period for phi is an integer times the period of S. If I do that, then so this is the type of trajectory that passes through the origin and never goes to the negative region, to the anti-gravity region. So this is a plot of phi, what phi does, and this is a plot what S does. They both go through zero, as you can see, simultaneously as time goes on. So what happens to A in the meantime, which is obtained as a function of phi squared minus S squared? What happens to A is that it starts with a big bang, for example. It goes, expands to a maximum, and then contracts. It hits zero in at the crunch, and then starts again and keeps on going. And so that's the cyclic universe. Now, all that, these pictures are in the case when the parameter B was positive. If the parameter B is negative, then the picture changes by moving this thing all the way to infinity, which means that A, the universe expands all the way to infinity and then turns around. I will skip that there are interesting regions of the plot where there is temporary inflation. There are many such periods of temporary inflation. Could we be living in one of them is one question I wanted to ask, but maybe we can discuss in private. So now, what happens in the case of anisotropic metrics? anisotropic metrics, the general case with curvature is the Bianchi-Nine metric. If you take the limit of zero curvature, that becomes the Kasner metric. So this adds two functions of time, so which I call them alpha 1 and alpha 2 over here. And in the case of non-zero curvature, then there is a potential energy, which is this particular potential energy that Misner had derived for these parameters alpha 1 and alpha 2. So alpha 1 and alpha 2 behave just like as if you are adding two more scalars, just like the sigma. So adding just two more scalars to the theory. If the curvature is zero, the potential vanishes. And so these two additional scalars just behave as if they are free scalars, just additional sigma 1 and sigma 2, or alpha 1, alpha 2, just like free scalars. So then their momenta, defined in this way, the canonical conjugate momenta defined in this way, become conserved quantities in any part of the motion. So therefore, in the absence of potentials, you can find that all solutions are, again, analytically, you can find them again analytically. So this is in the case of k equal to 0, you can find it for alpha 1 and alpha 2. Now, if you are near the singularity, then it turns out that the potential for sigma also becomes negligible compared to its kinetic energy. So it becomes kinetic energy dominated. So I call the momentum canonical conjugate to sigma, I call it Q. So therefore, the three parameters I need to worry about are P1, P2, and Q that are conserved quantities if I am close to the singularity. And then in addition, I still have the parameters radiation and K. So in this parameter space, we can still solve the equations completely, and this is the solution. So phi plus S is some expression of tau, and phi minus S is an expression of tau, which depends in, this is for the k equals 0 case, they are this, and there is a more complicated expression for k not equal 0 case. So now if you plot this, again, in this phi S plane, it becomes a curve like that. As it approaches the origin, both phi and S vanish, so you hit the origin, and then you follow, and then you must go, it turns out, the solution tells you must go into the anti-gravity regime, you make a loop, and come back into gravity regime again. So this is a consequence that is always there, independent of the potential. So no matter which potential you take, this is always going to be there. And then you can see that there is a focusing of that both phi and S are vanishing at the origin. Remember, previously I had assumed in order to have geodesic completeness only in the gravity regime, I had assumed take phi and S equal to 0. This is no longer necessary, independent of any initial conditions you start with. There is a focusing that pushes, because of anisotropy, it pushes both phi and S to go through 0, so therefore one can forget about that additional constraint. Because this is, will always happen near the origin, and near the origin then we must always have this anti-gravity loop. So this is the consequence. This is in the case of k equal to 0. What happens? So let's say you go through a bank and you are expanding. Because of curvature, you have to come back. And then when you come near the origin, then you go into an anti-gravity loop and then go into gravity and then come back, go again into anti-gravity and come back again. Okay, so now if these loops become large, which depends on the parameters P1, P2, Q, and so on. It depends on those parameters, how large they can become. So if they become sufficiently large, then the approximation for these equations I just showed you breaks down, then the potentials have to be included. If the loops are sufficiently large, and they are measured basically by the duration of the loop, and the duration of the loop depends on this ratio, that includes radiation. So if this duration becomes large, then you are getting away from the singularity sufficiently where you have to begin to include the effect of the potential. If you do that, then in the case of zero curvature, you don't need to worry about P1 and P2. They are always conserved. But Q is going to change from the beginning of the loop to the end of the loop. So you are going to come in with some value of Q, and then in the gravity regime, and then come out again into gravity regime with a different value of Q. All right, so this will happen in the case of non-zero curvature. It will happen also in the gravity region, not only in the anti-gravity region. It just depends on how large the loops become, depending on the solution. But the solution is always governed, the exact solution always governed by this six-parameter space that I mentioned earlier. All right, so here is a summary of what we have learned. First of all, we have found a new technique to solve cosmological equations analytically, and then this allowed us to find all the solutions for the potential I showed you, but not only for that one, a couple of other potentials also that are different than that one. We can solve it exactly. So we have a set of potentials from which at least we can try to extract lessons for those other cases that we cannot solve exactly. So, but we have this new technique that should be helpful, I think, to everyone that wishes to solve the Friedmann equations. Then anti-gravity, it turns out to be very, very hard to avoid. For the past 6 months, we've tried very, very hard to avoid it. We tried very hard to find ways of avoiding it, and at the end, we could not avoid it. So it's very hard to avoid, so anisotropy seems to require it. So maybe later we may find some other mechanism, perhaps, but for now, we think it is relevant to take in, to be taken into account. Now, we have also studied the Wheeler-DeWitt equation for the same system, which is exactly solvable. So in parts of the parameter space, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation also becomes exactly solvable, and we could find, again, all of its solutions. And in some other cases, we could only solve it semi-classically, depending on which parameters we include. And the general conclusion, the physics is very similar, except for the fuzziness of the quantum effects. So again, all of the same things that I have mentioned at the classical level, they show up at least at the semi-classical level. Open questions, which we have not had the time so far, but we intend to do, is that are there observational effects today that in our past there is anti-gravity period? So this is an important future project that we are working on, and I hope those of you who may have some ideas to suggest, we would very much like to hear about your opinions. And also the study of the small fluctuations and the fitting to current observations. So all of these are still projects that will try to use this complete set of solutions and see which subset, which part of this parameter space maybe may or may not fit observations for this particular potential. Of course, we can change the potential and eventually, like other cosmologists, we can also fit things, but maybe we can do better without having to play with initial conditions and so on, the kinds of problems that we've been talking about. So it's an effort that we are going to make. We don't know the outcome. Now, question, of course, is this new insight going to survive the effects of quantum theory for gravity, so such as string theory? Is this new observation about anti-gravity and about possibility of the solutions, can it affect the study of string theory? I think it should. And then finally, I want to make the remark that there are direct predictions of two-time physics coming from 4 plus 2 dimensions. Although I managed to state everything in the language of only one-time physics, one-time physics does not demand that all the scalars should be conformally coupled scalars, but two-time physics does demand that. So therefore, in that sense, it is a prediction of two-time gravity. With one-time gravity, you may have a few other choices to play with, in particular when you begin adding more and more scalars. But if assuming that this new effect survives, it can be considered to be one of the predictions coming from two-time physics. So I'll stop there.
So I would suggest that while we take questions, Bing Khan can perhaps start setting up.